You're listening to the North American Service Broadcast from London, and leads the listeners in North, South, and Central America in the 25 and 31 meter band. London calling. Britain speaks, and it is the voice of one of Britain's best-known speakers, J.B. Priestley, which you hear. Mr. Priestley.
British war production is now level with German war production. British war production, notice. Our own war production here in this island. We are now producing at least as many aeroplanes a month as Germany is, and they are much better aeroplanes than Germany is. And when I say we, I don't mean all the people in the Allied nations. I mean the people of this island of Britain. Now, this overtaking of Nazi Germany in war production is one of the most remarkable feats in history. I venture to say myself that it's the most extraordinary achievement that this island and its people can claim. Its magnitude and character are not yet appreciated. We don't appreciate them ourselves yet. We hardly realize what we've done, being so busy doing it. Let's look closer at this astonishing race between two neighboring peoples. The Nazis began with all the odds on their side. When the Nazis took over the country, there were several million unemployed in Germany, and the German heavy industries, some of whose leaders had already subsidized Hitler, were working at only a fraction of their capacity. So Hitler and his friends decided to kill several birds with one stone. They had to settle their unemployment problem as quick as possible. They had to make the fullest possible use of their heavy industries. And they were determined to make Germany the strongest military power in the world. So strong that it would be able to defy international law, custom and ethics, and become, in fact, a gigantic Britain state whose staple industry was aggression. So the Nazis began building their tremendous war machine. The people they controlled were almost ideal people for this particular purpose. They were, for the most part, naturally obedient and docile, only too anxious to receive orders. And in addition, they were, of course, immensely industrious and had a genius for patient, detailed organization. Moreover, their national traditions were militarist, so that the idea of spending their time and energy creating instruments of destruction wasn't repugnant to them, but instantly aroused their pride and loyalty. Within a year or two of the Nazis taking over the country, the people were already living in a war atmosphere. They were strictly rationed. They were drilled and disciplined. They saw uniforms and marching men everywhere. Their national pride was constantly heightened and inflamed. Every aggressive instinct, so long as it faced outward towards other nations, was artfully fostered. A huge propaganda department, directed by the cunning and unscrupulous Goebbels, took charge of the press, the radio, the films and theatres, literature and the arts, so that everything that was said and done should serve this war machine and the men were preparing to make use of it. An equally efficient and ruthless police department, under Himmler, saw to it that adverse criticism of the Nazis and their policy should cease and that the more persistent critics should disappear. The world stared uneasily at this astonishing spectacle of a great people toiling like beavers and ants in a so-called time of peace to build all the machinery of war. Most of us didn't realize then how vast this effort was, though now and again we were solemnly warned that it was reaching a terrifying size. Here in Britain, Winston Churchill made one impressive speech after another, warning the House of Commons and the people that Nazi Germany was now arming rapidly and ruthlessly and on an unprecedented scale. He was accused of being a mere warmonger. Let us admit that the prevailing mood of the democracies, and especially among the more comfortable classes, was then an unrealistic one, the mood of men who were determined not to face unpleasant facts, and so pretend to themselves that the facts aren't there. Hitler and Goering and their gang grinned and chortled in private while announcing any smooth nonsense in public and hurried on, adding bombing squadron to bombing squadron, tank to tank, gun to gun, and began to reveal by their growing insolence to the outside world their belief that very soon they would be able to take civilization to pieces. Had we in the democracies left it too late? The Nazis believed we had. Many people outside Germany, people who didn't particularly like the Nazis, believed we had, and hastened to make friends with these potential world beaters. The Nazis and the fascists, and the not very strong-minded people who began to be influenced by them, made no secret of their contempt for the democratic people and the democratic idea. We were, it appeared, a decadent lot, well past our prime, no longer capable of making the terrific effort necessary to challenge successfully, I quote one of their favorite phrases, these younger and more virile people. We were going down as fast as they were coming up. The future belonged to them, and not the distant future either, but the immediate future. Well, when the last attempt at what was generally known as appeasement had failed, when it was obvious that the world was to be given up to war again, we in Britain, at the very last dangerous moment, accepted the challenge. Remember, we were suffering from every possible disadvantage except one, to which I'll come later. There were 45 million of us in this island, and about 70 million of them. They had about 7 years' start of us. They'd been living and toiling in a war atmosphere for years, during which we'd amused ourselves and hoped for the best. We were an easygoing democracy, while they were an iron dictatorship, in which every man, woman, and child could be ordered at once into uniform or into a war factory. They liked this kind of life. Its nonsense suited their nonsense, whereas we detested it. Their traditions were in favor of it, while our traditions were against it. That challenge looked hopeless. The odds looked worse than those on David versus Goliath. Moreover, to make matters still worse, our really big effort had to be made not only when the war was on, but also when that war was going badly against us, when the whole coast of Europe facing us was in Nazi hands, when the seas surrounding us were swarming with U-boats, when the bombing armadas of the Luftwaffe were menacing us day and night, when invasion was an immediate possibility. Whereas they had a little improved month by month from the gigantic organization of war industry they created when we were ostensibly at peace, we had to improvise in the very shadow and menace of war itself, when already our towns were burning and the air raid sirens were screaming outside our factory gates. Nor is that all. For with the sudden conquest of Western Europe, Nazi Germany could add enormously to her 70 million. By looting the occupied countries and then controlling the food supply, the Nazis could compel the hungry masses in these unhappy countries to supply a kind of slave labor that would vastly increase their manpower. The result was that factories far outside the frontiers of Germany were now working for the Nazi war machine. And this is what we had to challenge and to beat at the last desperate minute with hell roaring all round us. And we have challenged it. And we're beginning to beat it. And the Nazis know it. That old insolence and swagger have vanished. We no longer hear any of those taunts about the decadent democracies. Not a word now about Britain being finished. Even Goebbels hasn't the impudence to tell the people in the Ruhr, in Cologne, in Lübeck and Rostock, in Bremen and Hamburg, that Britain is finished. Even he daren't tell the men in the shattered Luftwaffe squadrons, or in the sorely battered Africa Corps, that the British are no longer capable of fighting total war. He and his gang should have read Mein Kampf with more care, but in that fantastic work, it's freely admitted by the author, whose judgment then hadn't been completely corrupted by power, that the British are an exceptionally tough and tenacious people, who once they are thoroughly aroused, will carry on to the bitter end. We've changed these people's tune for them and wiped those silly, insolent grins off their faces. We've done what was thought to be impossible, entered the race years behind them with far fewer people, retained our democracy, and yet caught up with this grim empire of ruthlessness, torture, and slavery. We had, I said, every disadvantage except one. But that one advantage has outweighed all the disadvantages. It is the advantage of the free mind and the unburdened heart. This country of Britain is a better country than it was 10 years ago. How many Germans, once out of reach of the Gestapo, would admit that Germany is a better country than it was 10 years ago? They know, as so many American correspondents from Germany have told us, that they are living in a gigantic prison. The very air stifles and corrupts them. Their laurels wither in that air. Triumphs turn at once to dust. Their minds move restlessly and with growing uneasiness in the mere prison yard around them. Their hearts are burdened and darkened by a feeling of guilt. The hatred and contempt of the world fills them with growing dismay. They are living in a kind of nightmare. Their leaders disappear, having gone suddenly mad, they are told, or been visited by strange illnesses. The Gestapo are everywhere, accusing, condemning, striking down.